Assumption of risk is a defense, specifically an affirmative defense, in the law of torts, which bars or reduces a plaintiff's right to recovery against a negligent tortfeasor if the defendant can demonstrate that the plaintiff voluntarily and knowingly assumed the risks at issue inherent to the dangerous activity in which the plaintiff was participating at the time of their injury. Primary versus secondary. Primary assumption of risk occurs when the plaintiff knows about a particular risk and, through words or conduct, accepts that risk, thereby relieving the defendant of its duty of care. The primary assumption of risk defense operates as a complete bar to recovery. For example, someone who goes skiing assumes the risk that they will fall and break a bone and cannot sue a ski resort for such an injury in the absence of additional fault, such as the failure to properly maintain safety equipment. Secondary assumption of risk exists where the defendant has a continuing duty of reasonable care to the plaintiff, but the plaintiff knows about the risk caused by the defendant's negligence and proceeds despite that knowledge. For example, an employer supplies an employee with a defective piece of machinery, and knowing the machinery is defective, the employee proceeds to use it anyway, albeit carefully. If the machinery causes injury, the employer may have a secondary assumption of risk defense. In comparative negligence jurisdictions, secondary assumption of risk is applied as a factor that the jury can consider in apportioning fault, rather than a complete defense. The California Supreme Court explained the difference between primary and secondary assumption of risk, under California law, as follows. In cases involving primary assumption of risk, where, by virtue of the nature of the activity and the party's relationship to the activity, the defendant owes no legal duty to protect the plaintiff from the particular risk of harm that caused the injury, the doctrine continues to operate as a complete bar to the plaintiff's recovery. In cases involving secondary assumption of risk, where the defendant does owe a duty of care to the plaintiff, but the plaintiff proceeds to encounter a known risk imposed by the defendant's breach of duty, the doctrine is merged into the comparative fault scheme, and the trier of fact, in apportioning the loss resulting from the injury, may consider the relative responsibility of the parties. Some states have abrogated the primary assumption of risk defense in certain situations because they have determined that the defendant in that situation should not be absolved of its duty of care, even if the plaintiff assumed the risk, such as by signing a premises liability waiver. States have, for example, passed laws abrogating primary assumption of risk for employers engaged in dangerous activities and for landlords with regard to safety conditions on their properties. Express versus implied. Express assumption of risk occurs when the plaintiff explicitly accepts the risk, whether by oral or written agreement. For example, a gym requires its members to sign a liability waiver stating that the gym is not legally responsible for any injuries if the member drops heavy weights on themselves. A signed liability waiver, however, is not a blanket exemption from liability for operators of a dangerous activity. The specific risk causing the injury must have been known to, and appreciated by, the plaintiff in order for primary assumption of risk to apply. Courts often refuse to enforce a general liability waiver if it fails to inform the signer of the specific risk that caused the injury. Additionally, even an express assumption of risk cannot absolve a defendant of liability for reckless conduct, only negligent conduct. Implied assumption of risk occurs when the plaintiff's conduct demonstrates that the plaintiff knew of the risk and proceeded anyway. If the implied assumption of risk is eligible for the primary assumption of risk defense, the defendant has no liability. If the implied assumption does not qualify for primary assumption of risk, the plaintiff's award may be reduced by the amount of fault the fact finder determines the plaintiff to have by knowing the risk and proceeding anyway. An example of implied assumption of risk is when a spectator goes to a baseball game. The spectator is deemed to accept the risk of being hit by foul balls or home runs. The implied assumption of risk defense is commonly asserted in cases of injuries occurring during risky recreational activities, such as skiing, paragliding, and scuba diving, but actually extends to all dangerous activities. Thus, for example, it was held that a visitor to the Burning Man festival assumed the risk of getting burned. The defense of property is a common method of justification used by defendants who argue that they should not be held liable for any loss and injury that they have caused because they were acting to protect their property. English law. Generally, see self-defense in English law. In addition to the right of self-defense at common law, Section 3 of the Criminal Law Act 1967 states that a person may use such force as is reasonable in the circumstances in the prevention of crime or in arresting offenders or suspects. Insofar as an attack on property is a crime, reasonable force may be used to prevent the crime or to arrest the offender, whether it be theft of a sum of money or the damage of an object. In many cases of robbery and burglary, the threat will be to both a person and property, and this combination can be a powerful defense. In A.G.'s reference, No. 2 of 1983, 1984, held that a defendant who manufactured 10 petrol bombs to defend his shop during the Toxteth riots could set up the defense of showing that he possessed an explosive substance for a lawful purpose if he could show he acted to protect himself or his family or property by means he believed reasonably necessary to meet the attack. In theory, the defense of property by itself cannot reasonably provide a justification for inflicting serious injury, but there are a number of cases approving considerable violence to arrest criminals threatening property. Although R. v. Scully, 1824, held that it was not justifiable to shoot an intruder merely to arrest him, on the facts, the life of the prisoner was threatened, and if he considered his life in actual danger, he was justified in shooting the deceased as he had done, but if, not considering his own life in danger, he rashly shot this man, who was only a trespasser, he would be guilty of manslaughter. In Mead and Belt's case, 1823, Holroyd J. instructed a jury that violence could not be used against a civil trespasser, adding, but, the making an attack upon a dwelling, and especially at night, the law regards as equivalent to an assault on a man's person, for a man's house is his castle and therefore, in the eye of the law, it is equivalent to an assault. One recent case on using force against a burglar is Anthony Martin v. R., 2001, which resulted in the householder being convicted. As the law currently stands, a person in possession can use no more force than they reasonably believe necessary to remove a trespasser from the premises. Further, where the threat to the land or its possession is not immediate, and other measures could be taken that would make force unnecessary, for example, calling the police or seeking remedies through the courts, the defense will normally be lost. But in Chamberlain v. Linden, 1998, demolished a wall to protect a right-of-way, honestly believing that it was a reasonable means of protecting his property, and, incidentally, avoiding litigation. It was held that it was not necessary to decide whether Linden's action was justified as a matter of civil law. For the purpose of the criminal law, what mattered was whether Linden believed that his actions were reasonable. Although this case is on the specific interpretation of the statutory defense under S5 Criminal Damage Act 1971, the fact that the defendant was not out of time after 9 months of inaction is interesting. In a similar statutory defense, DPP v. Bayer and others, 2004, dealt with defense of private property as a defense to aggravated trespass under Section 68 of the Criminal Justice and Public Order Act 1994. The court held that if defendants argued they had used reasonable force to defend property from actual or imminent damage that would constitute a criminal act, then the court had to consider whether, on the facts as the defendants honestly believed them to be, the force used was reasonable in all the circumstances. Reform. The defense of private defense or protective force, when unlawful force is used or threatened against a person who may use proportionate force to defend persons or property, is distinguished from the line of authority concerned with a similar defense against trespassers. In the Law Commission's Report No. 218 Offenses Against the Person and General Principles, 1993, these defenses are set out, so far as they relate to defense of property, as follows. 27. The use of force by a person for any of the following purposes, if only such as is reasonable in the circumstances as he believes them to be, does not constitute an offense. C. To protect his property from trespass. D. To protect property belonging to another from damage caused by a criminal act or, with the authority of the other, from trespass. 29. For the purposes of S. 27.
A. A person uses force in relation to
property not only where he applies force to, but also where he causes an impact on that property. In tort common law, the defense of necessity gives the state or an individual a privilege to take or use the property of another. A defendant typically invokes the defense of necessity only against the intentional torts of trespass to chattels, trespass to land, or conversion. The Latin phrase from common law is necessitas inducit privilegium quod jura privata, necessity induces a privilege because of a private right. A court will grant this privilege to a trespasser when the risk of harm to an individual or society is apparently and reasonably greater than the harm to the property. Unlike the privilege of self-defense, those who are harmed by individuals invoking the necessity privilege are usually free from any wrongdoing. Generally, an individual invoking this privilege is obligated to pay any actual damages caused in the use of the property but not punitive or nominal damages. Private necessity. Private necessity is the use of another's property for private reasons. Well-established doctrines in common law prevent a property owner from using force against an individual in a situation where the privilege of necessity would apply. While an individual may have a private necessity to use the land or property of another, that individual must compensate the owner for any damages caused. For example, a strong wind blows a parachuting skydiver off course from his intended landing zone. He must land in a nearby farmer's field. The skydiver tramples on the farmer's prized roses, and the farmer hits the skydiver on the head with a pitchfork. The skydiver can invoke the privilege of private necessity for trespassing in the farmer's fields but will have to pay for the damage caused to the roses. The farmer will be liable for battery because the use of force in defense of property is not privileged against an individual who successfully claims private necessity. In American law, the case most often cited to explain the privilege of private necessity is Vincent v. Lake Erie Transportation Company, 1910. Vincent v. Lake Erie Transportation Company. Facts. Defendant Lake Erie was at the dock of plaintiff Vincent to unload cargo from Reynolds, the steamship owned by the defendant. An unusually violent storm developed. Lake Erie was unable to leave the dock safely and deckhands for the steamship instead tied the Reynolds to the dock, continually changing ropes as they began to wear and break. A sudden fierce wind threw the ship against the dock, significantly damaging the dock. Issue. Is compensation required when there is damage to another's property due to a private necessity? Decision. Judge O'Brien, yes. A private necessity may require one to take or damage another's property, but compensation is required. If the Reynolds had entered the harbor at the time the storm began, and the wind knocked her against the dock, this force of nature would not have allowed Vincent to recover. The defendant, Lake Erie, deliberately kept the Reynolds tied to the dock. If they had not done so, the ship could have been lost, creating a far greater damage than what was caused to the dock. Although this was a prudent thing to do, Lake Erie is still liable to Vincent for the damage caused. Dissent. Judge Lewis, one who constructs a dock and conducts business assumes a risk of damage that may occur from storms. For this reason, Judge Lewis did not agree with the majority and believed that Vincent had assumed the risk of damage caused by Lake Erie. To invoke the private necessity privilege, the defendant must have been actually threatened or have reasonably thought that a significant harm was about to occur. The ruling in Vincent v. Lake Erie assures private citizens from a public policy standpoint that they will be compensated for their loss. Vincent will be compensated for repairs and Lake Erie can rest assured that their ship will not sink. Public necessity. Public necessity is the use of private property by a public official for a public reason. The potential harm to society necessitates the destruction or use of private property for the greater good. The injured, private individual does not always recover for the damage caused by the necessity. In American law, two conflicting cases illustrate this point: Scirocco v. Geary, 1853, and Wegner v. Milwaukee Mutual Insurance Company, 1991. Scirocco v. Geary. Facts. San Francisco was hit by a major fire. The plaintiff, Scirocco, was attempting to remove goods from his home while the fire raged nearby. The defendant and mayor of San Francisco, Geary, authorized that the plaintiff's home be demolished to stop the progress of the fire and to prevent its spread to nearby buildings. Scirocco sued the mayor, claiming he could have recovered more of his possessions had his house not been blown up. Issue. Is a person liable for the private property of another if destroying that property would prevent an imminent public disaster? Decision. No. The right of necessity falls under natural law and exists independent of society and government. Individual rights must give way to the higher law of impending necessity. A house on fire or about to catch on fire is a public nuisance which is lawful to abate. Otherwise, one stubborn person could destroy an entire city. If property is destroyed without an apparent necessity, the destroying person would be liable to the property owner for trespass. Here, blowing up Scirocco's house was necessary to stop the fire. Any delay in blowing up the house to allow him to remove more of his possessions would have made blowing up the house too late. The decision in Scirocco v. Geary differs from the private necessity doctrine that a trespasser must compensate a property owner for any damage she may cause. Wegner v. Milwaukee Mutual Insurance Company. This case coincides with the private necessity doctrine and shows that American courts are conflicted on the issue of compensation for damage. Facts. A suspected felon barricaded himself inside of plaintiff Wegner's house. The Minneapolis Police Department fired tear gas canisters and concussion grenades into the house, causing extensive damage. Wegner sued the defendant, the city of Minneapolis, for trespass. Wegner claimed that the city's actions constituted a taking of his property under principles similar to those outlined in the Fifth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. This was a taking of his private property for public use, and so the city was required to compensate him for it. The city claimed there was no taking because the police's actions were a legitimate exercise of police power. Lower courts ruled that the city was justified under the doctrine of public necessity and that the city was not required to compensate Wegner. Wegner appealed to the state Supreme Court in its claim against the city's insurance company. Issue. Must a city compensate a homeowner whose property was damaged in the apprehension by police of a suspect? Decision. Judge Tomljanovich, yes. Under Minnesota's constitution, the government must compensate a landowner for any damage it causes when it takes private land for public use. Whether the police acted reasonably is not relevant. The constitutional provision is not limited to an improvement of property for public use. The doctrine of public necessity does not change our holding. Once a taking has been found to exist, compensation is required. If the public necessity doctrine were to apply to a situation like this, no taking would ever be found. Fairness and justice require this result. It would not be fair for Wegner to suffer the burden of his loss for the public good. Therefore, the city must bear his loss. In addition, the individual police officers are not personally liable, the public must bear the loss. It is an issue of public policy to determine if either private individuals or the public at large through taxes should bear the loss for damages caused through public necessity. Wegner v. Milwaukee allocates the loss that benefits the public to the public rather than to Wegner, the innocent citizen. Cases with similar facts to Wegner, for example Leitch v. City of Greenwood Village, have used the public necessity doctrine under Scirocco, and the individual must bear the cost of the greater public good. Courts determine this issue as a matter of public policy.